The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in tonight. A quick note, we're using the 60-minute format tonight, so we will be making sure that we end in 1 hour. So if you do want to get an email question or comment in to our guest, Dr. Mike Griffin, or a call, plan it so that you can meet our time constraints. And I'll remind you of that as the show goes on, too. So, again, 60-minute format. Our phone number, for those of you who would like to call, is 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then for those of you wanting to post a comment on the blog or a question on the blog, it is thespaceshow.com. All the way over to the far right side, upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed. Open up that page, which is our archive page, and comments and questions are, as always, down at the bottom. And as soon as you post your comment, I can integrate it into our discussion. Excuse me. Also, do please check out our website newsletter. You'll see that on the website. It is the detailed plan for the week. But if you scroll down a little further, you'll see all of the programs we have planned, and we're booking shows right now into early October. So do check that out for sure. And then, in addition, a couple of things to quickly point out. In the upper left menu, don't forget there is a Listen Live button that tells you how to listen to live shows as well as archive shows. Feel free to share that information with people that you want to hear the program or that are interested in the program, because that really tells them how to do it. You can listen on our archives right off of our website, or very quickly download our programs, and you can listen on whatever device you have. If you have any questions or listening problems with your device or with the podcast or anything of that nature, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and I'll do my best to help you. We are trademarked and copyrighted, so please remember our 3 rules: nothing commercial, don't do any edits of any kind, don't put anything up on YouTube or anything like that, and written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And then in addition to that, we have sponsors that are both individual and corporate. So as a 501c3 nonprofit, we do raise funds from individuals, mostly through PayPal or your individual check. As a 501c3, your gifts, if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, are tax deductible. For those of you paying California taxes, we're a public benefit corporation over here, and therefore you get a tax break in California as well. So if you have any questions, please visit our parent site that owns and controls the Space Show, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. That is the 501c3. And if you have any questions or comments, don't hesitate to contact me about that. And then corporate sponsors, you'll see their banner ads going across our website. Check them out from time to time. They do change the content behind those banners from time to time. We could not be doing our show without the corporate sponsors and without those of you who individually support us. So we thank you very, very much for your support. Because this is a 60-minute format, I am not going to read sponsor messages tonight on the show, but I do want to mention our corporate sponsors and, again, thank them. So we have the Integrated Space Plan, the Space Foundation, AIAA, and Orbital ATK, and we're deeply appreciative of their support. And for tonight, our guest, and it's always a pleasure for me to bring back to the show Dr. Mike Griffin. He really doesn't need an introduction, but for those of you who may not be that familiar with Mike, he was a NASA administrator from 05 to 09. He was nominated by President George W. Bush. He was confirmed by the U.S. Senate. His full bio is on the website. He has multiple academic degrees from first-class universities in business and engineering and physics. And he, I think, really knows his stuff. He's a great guy to talk to about policy and technical matters. And, again, read his bio on the website. And if you want to talk to Mike yourself and give us your questions or comments, use our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. And email again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Mike, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
I'm just fine, David. Thanks for having me back on. If I count correctly, I think this is the fourth time, right?
Fourth or fifth. I didn't count before the show, but either the fourth or fifth. I trust your math ability, so I'll go with four.
I hope your listeners aren't getting jaded of me, but anyway... What do you want to talk about tonight?
Well, let's do a couple of really hot button questions and get your views on it for the space show audience. Okay, so because the space show has a group of people that come out of the new space community and really think SLS is the worst possible thing since I don't know polio or something. I mean, it's horrible. It's taking money away that NASA could use on much better projects, specifically commercial space projects, going back to the moon, this, that, or the other. And then others really understand sort of a multi-role purpose of having a government launch vehicle. And then on top of that, we have a group of listeners who think you don't need heavy lift, that you can do multiple smaller lifts more efficiently than having one big, giant, heavy lift rocket. And then others say, nah, if you're going to go beyond LEO, going to do interesting things, go to Mars, heavy lift is the answer. Can you kind of give us your perspective and an analysis on SLS and its cost structure plus heavy lift versus a lot of smaller launches that might be cheaper?
Well, I can comment. Sure, I can give you my perspective. So I guess the first thing I'll say is the listeners who believe that you can, pardon me, accomplish great goals in space exploration without a heavy lifter are, from a physics point of view, perfectly correct. As I think I've said before in public forums, I mean, everything except people, you can launch in packages as small as you want. And you can integrate those packages wherever you want. I mean, you can launch nuts, bolts, and screws and sheet aluminum if you want to do that. My opinion after, 46 years now as an engineer and a manager of engineers is that that's not the most efficient way to do it. That within reason, you want to integrate your packages on the ground and launch them as a unified whole into space. I think that point could be carried to extremes. I'm not suggesting to pick a number that we launch the Queen Mary into space in one whole unit, but somewhere between that and launching, as I say, the nuts, bolts, and screws, I think, an efficient working arrangement lies. And I would point to, for this view, to justify this view, I would point to other modes of transportation where, human activity has very clearly in the maritime industry gone from, smaller ships to supertankers and large container ships, as large aircraft design companies like Boeing and Airbus have learned to do it. We've gone from smaller airplanes to, A380s and 787s. So there's some history here to guide us as well. So I'll just stop there on that topic. I'm not a fan of launching multi-hundred ton payloads, you know, 10 or 20 tons at a time. So I'm sorry, David, go ahead.
When you're talking about taking people, say, to Mars, I'm suspecting then you want to be able to have the heavier lift and payload to get them out there rather than have a lot of transition points along the way or something of that nature, right?
Well, generally speaking. Now, I don't think you're going to go from the surface of the Earth to the surface of Mars in one shot, and you're going to have some way stations along the way. And, you know, I enjoy debating where you want to park the transfer nodes. That issue's not settled yet. But certainly people and their life support, the people can only be made so small. And, you do reach a lower limit of what size package you can put up and still carry people. But transitioning now to the issue of from the issue of whether we should have a heavy lifter at all to whether or not there should be a government heavy lifter. I find myself puzzled by some aspects of the commercial space debate, because I have to say that even on my government record, I would offer to say that very few people are more supportive of commercial space development than I. But the definition of a commercial activity is not that a different contractor wants the money because they believe that they can be better than established contractors. The definition of a commercial activity is one in which a private entity, through one means or another, raises its own money, invests in its product or service, brings that to fruition, and then sells it on the open market for all that the traffic will bear. I have run a commercial business. If any commercial entity finds that it thinks it can generate a business case by building a heavy lifter, then I think they should go to it. And when they have it finished, I recommend the government buy such a service. I've not seen any private entity come forward and say, we want to build, a commercial heavy lifter. Now, I have seen people come forward who think that the SLS contract shouldn't have gone to Boeing, that it should have gone somewhere else. And I guess, in all reason, every large aerospace contractor who isn't Boeing wishes they'd gotten that job. But the government picked Boeing, and it's a government project, and that issue is settled for me. So let me stop there. If someone thinks that some other entity wants to do it on their own nickel and then it is thereby commercial, then I'm all for that.
So, again, going back to many in my listener base, they claim Falcon Heavy with SpaceX is a heavy lifter and therefore they can do it better than the government and should sell Falcon Heavy to the government. So, how do you define a heavy lifter?
Well, we at NASA, the last time I was there, we looked at the question of what the useful size for a heavy lifter could be. And what we came up with was, once again, if you want to do lunar return, which was our charter under President Bush, we were not at that time talking about immediately going to Mars, as people are now talking. But what we came up with was that you really need around 130 metric tons as the floor. That below that, you have to start breaking up payloads in awkward ways. Can you find a way to do it with 50 or 60 metric tons? Sure, you can find a way to do it with almost anything. But if you want to do it in a reasonably effective manner, that's what we came up with. So I don't consider, you know, Falcon. First of all, Falcon 9 Heavy doesn't yet exist. But even if it did, it's, you know, last I checked, something like a factor of 2.5 below what we would really like to have.
Describing Falcon Heavy as a heavy lifter, the way that NASA did it and probably still does it today, they're not equal.
Well, they're not by several factors.
In terms of just this is a heavier lifter, it's just a small heavy lifter, so that doesn't cut it, right?
Well, it doesn't meet the architectural requirements for returning to the moon, returning to the vicinity of the moon, putting payloads together for Mars in as effective a way as the SLS does, because the SLS was designed to meet the requirements that I just spoke of. You know, it was designed for the well over 100 metric tons to low Earth orbit as an equivalent number. That wasn't an accident. That wasn't just picked out of a hat. It was the result of study. Now, the other point I would make, I think there's a principle of fairness and good governance involved here. At the time that the heavy lifter sizing decisions and you know, contractual mechanisms were being decided, the Falcon Heavy wasn't on the table. And the experience base just wasn't there for other alternatives. So procurements are decided, you know, designs are specified, procurements are decided, contracts are awarded, and people move down the road. Other contractors don't get the option to come along later and say, well, I'd like to redo this competition because I think I can do it better. We don't, as a matter of normal government procurement awarding tax dollars, we don't redecide competitions. It happens only when the winner, the prior winner, has proven themselves unable to do the job. In such a case, we might cancel and start over, and I've seen those instances, and I'm sure have many of our listeners. But just because someone comes along and raises their hand and says, I can do that job too, well, you know, where were you when we were doing the procurement?
In terms of your sense of things, and I know things are kind of up in the air with space or anything, is... in your opinion, the SLS project, is it pretty secure for actual development and onto operations, or because of the high cost and economic issues in the country and wanting to constrain spending and who knows what else we may read tomorrow morning, could it be at risk of being canceled this far down into the program?
Well, I mean, honestly, having served many years in government, I'm not sure that I would ever consider any program immune to cancellation. So what I will say is that I think SLS is proceeding along technically quite well. It has, for the last quite a number of years, been annually starved of funding. They've gotten the minimum amount of funding necessary to accomplish goals, and that has caused some schedule slips. But I personally, when I look at it, I think it's doing well and doing pretty much as advertised. Now, I think, though, I can't leave this question, David, without saying we've got, one more time, we've got the cart before the horse. The purpose of the space program is not to build a heavy lifter. The purpose of a taxpayer-funded American space program is to make our nation a leader in space and to do great things in space. And if we want to go beyond Earth orbit, if we think that is part of being a great nation in space, if we want to go beyond low Earth orbit, then from that conclusion follows the secondary conclusion, yes, a heavy lifter is highly desirable. But we don't build a rocket just to build a rocket. The idea is to have it be in service to a great space program, and it's that latter thing that we're lacking and have lacked for some years.
And that brings me to a listener question, and this is from George, who is in Memphis, and he says, Dr. Griffin, we haven't had a great space program for a while. Lots of people now are talking about returning to the moon. Do you think if we actually have a space program that takes us back to the moon, would that be a great space program for this nation leading us forward?
Well, that is the path I prefer. And again, I'm going to say very few people want us to get to Mars any more than I do. I have spent my entire career in the space business one way or another, and I love it. I would like to think that even at my age, I could still live long enough to see humans set foot on Mars. I want to see that. But I think an efficiently run, intelligently developed architecture for exploring space focuses next on the moon. The next thing we need to be doing is learning how to live on the moon, function on the moon, explore it, extract resources. We haven't been out of Earth orbit in 45 years this December. And the hubris involved in saying that, well, we're ready to go to Mars, sometime in the early 2030s. It's bolder talk than I would accept.
Many commercial companies are planning to go to the moon, from smaller things like the Google Lunar X Prize, but others have plans as well. Does a great space program for a great nation include the private sector along with the government program, so a joint way of doing the moon with public and private is a good way to go, or should it only be government only?
Well, you're throwing me a softball because you know very well, David, I'm much on the record saying that once we have decided upon a sound government space policy, again, one, in my view, worthy of a great nation, you can conduct it in a number of different ways. And where and as it is possible to do so, we should conduct it in such a manner that it stimulates the development of private entities and commercial services. Now, the money trough which feeds all of those people for quite some time is going to have to come from government. But I don't think the government needs to build an Earth-Moon communications architecture, for example. It could, in the course of settling the moon, we're going to need trunk lines. I can't think of a reason in the world why the government couldn't buy bits instead of buying satellites. Now, we would need, availability assurances and things like that, as you always do, but I was a NASA flight controller at Goddard Space Flight Center back in the olden days, and I remember well when we switched from, government-owned telephone lines to buying the service from AT&T, and the world didn't fall apart. I used communications as one example. I can't see any reason why, in the course of developing the moon, NASA and our international partners wouldn't see fit to buy power on the moon from somebody who is in business to make money selling power. I can't see any reason why we wouldn't have supplies of all kinds delivered to the surface of the moon by commercial space transportation companies. So I personally think it will be a while before any fully private entity is, you know, qualified to provide passenger service to the moon. And so for a while, I think that's going to have to be a government activity. But when one goes about designing and defining the means by which we would develop the moon, doing it in such a fashion that we stimulate private sector development would be the right way to go. And I know that's a long-winded answer, and I'm sorry. I've spoken a lot on this topic, and I guess I haven't really changed my view.
No, and it's a great topic, and I think it needs to be repeated a lot, which is why I threw it out there for you, because you've said that on practically every show. But it is worth repeating, and good things are worth repeating more than once. So,
but working to develop or working to advance our nation's space program in such a fashion that it stimulates the development of private sector activities in parallel is not the same as providing subsidies. As I've said again many times, I'm a fiscal conservative and a capitalist, and I can find very few examples of where I think front-end subsidies are a good idea. I want to provide the government demand signal and let commercial entities respond.
You have another question from Helen, who is in Seattle. And Helen said, assuming the National Space Council actually gets into operation, which I don't think it is yet, is it the job of the National Space Council to help put into play that which you have been talking about for the past 10 minutes?
I'm sorry about the 10 minutes.
You have a lot to say. Uh-huh.
But I think that's one of the jobs of the National Space Council. It might not even be its most important job, and I want to return to that comment in just a moment. But I hope a National Space Council is put in place, because there are many issues in space, and I'll say government space, that cross organizational and agency boundaries. Between and among, you know, the Air Force, the intelligence community, NASA, NOAA, and so forth. And no one agency, you know, has the authority, the legal authority to sort all that out. It really needs to be, and frankly, no one congressional committee has the oversight responsibility for all of it together. It really needs to come together in the White House. And typically, presidents have other things to do with their time than plan out the space program. Those kinds of coordination functions really should be done by an appropriate entity within the White House. If you want to call it the National Space Council, that's fine. Now, I want to emphasize once again, as I've said many times, the purpose of the National Space Council is not to, you know, joggle the elbow of the Air Force Secretary or the NOAA Administrator or the NASA Administrator or the Director of the National Reconnaissance Office and so on. If you don't think those people are doing, you know, a good job in doing as they're asked, by the president and by the Congress, then they should be let go, and you should find people who will do a good job. So the Space Council, in brief, should not be a micromanager, but it could be very effective as a cross-government coordinator, and I would favor that. Now, returning to my first comment, yeah, one of the things that a Space Council might want to take a look at is to make sure that government entities are not intruding into areas where a commercial provider exists. Because when a commercial provider exists for a given product or service, we ought to try to buy from them, you know, absent other compelling reasons. But it is not, let me say once again, in a free market economy, it is not the job of government to bend over backwards to put commercial operators in business. It is the job of the government to stay out of their way while they ply their trade and to make sure that they have a friendly market in which to sell. But it's not the job of the government to create private activity where it would not otherwise exist. That gets into smacking of industrial policy, and I personally just not that much in favor of it.
Do we even know yet the progress on reviving the National Space Council? I mean, do we know who's going to be on it?
I don't know who the we is.
The people.
I know that I don't know.
So you haven't heard either?
No, I'm not. I'm not privy to what the administration is doing in that arena.
It would be nice to know if it's really going to happen, but I guess maybe it's too early still. I don't know.
As was attributed to Will Rogers, all I know is what I read in the newspaper. I really have no inside track on that.
Do you have any inside track on whether we are going to see an official return to the moon policy with this administration?
Well, again, no inside track. I think a number of our listeners, probably all of our listeners, because the space show is kind of a nerdy group, but I think all of our listeners probably have seen reports in Space News and Aviation Week, out briefings from the NASA transition team and reports that they've submitted, it would seem that if the administration accepts all that return to the moon would be in our future. I can only say I hope that's so.
One can hope that is true as well. Are you hearing anything about NASA administrator or anything like that coming down, or that's all out there in the dark world too?
Well, right. Again, I'm truly not privy to any of that. So I've seen the same rumors and the same, blogs and news articles that all of our listeners have seen.
Excuse me. I thought I had a caller, but they hung up on us before we. We got to it. When you were serving as administrator, I'm just curious, were things as contentious in policy as they seem to be today? Or do we always think the next administration is more contentious than the previous one?
While I was administrator, I walked into a regime in which the policy issues had very recently been settled. So let me remind you, I was first asked whether I wanted to be administrator the week after Sean O'Keefe left, my predecessor. So within a week after Sean left, I was approached by the White House and asked if I was interested in the job. There is a normal multi-week vetting process that one goes through before a public announcement is made, and that was done in I forget exactly when, but the first quarter of 2005. And then there's a period of time one waits for confirmation hearings. I was finally confirmed in mid-April of 2005. I don't remember the exact date. It doesn't matter. But that whole process from the first call I got until I was finally installed was, a five-month-long exercise. So by late 2004, if you'll recall, all of the arguments about what the United States should be doing in space that emerged after Columbia was lost, all those arguments had been settled. Now, there was a year in 2003 of fact-finding about the loss of Columbia, about reworking our space policy in light of that loss, one of the conclusions that the Columbia Accident Investigation Board brought forward was that space is and will for some time be expensive, difficult, and dangerous, and that the goals should be worthy of the risks. I mean, I think they said pretty much exactly that. And they made the point that confining ourselves to low Earth orbit was not such a goal. The Bush administration, to its credit, accepted that report and outlined a considerably bolder plan. We would return the shuttle to flight. We would finish the station. We would go to the moon again, this time to stay. And then we would go to Mars. And so future space hardware was to be designed with those goals in mind. So by the time I showed up in late 04, that had all been settled. And my job was to implement. Now, was there still some skepticism on the Hill when I took over? Yeah, there was. And I made it my business to convey the administration's policy. And broadly speaking, that went quite well. The NASA Authorization Act of 05, implementing what I just talked about, carried nearly unanimously in both House and Senate, and a redo of it in 08 under a Democratic Congress did the same. So the policy issues were scrabbled over and fought over before I took over, and then they didn't surface again until the Obama administration. So I'm really just reciting history for all of our listeners, but that's kind of where we were back then, you know, 10 years or so ago, David.
In a sense, then, your tour of duty was very different than whoever becomes the administrator today, because they're going to have to go through creating a policy, but that was already in place for you.
It was, and I felt very fortunate. I said several times in speeches that I thought that it's regrettable that it had to happen this way, but that a consequence of the Columbia accident was the development of the best space policy, in my opinion, that I had seen since John Kennedy. And I believed that then, and I believe it now. So truly my job was more of implementation. The things that that we at NASA were told to do in my time were certainly straightforward, and they could be expressed very simply, but they were hard. Returning the shuttle to flight and doing it safely and reliably and regularly, that was not easy. Finishing the station was not easy. We crafted the, you know, architecture for lunar return with, you know, something very similar to today's SLS, and as I think many of the listeners will recall, the smaller Ares 1, which was intended just to get through into orbit. So we were trying to implement the policy that was crafted for us, first of all, by presidential statements, and then was crafted for us in law. I mean, it was the law of the land until it was replaced in 2010 by a new policy.
I have another listener question. It's on a different topic. Bill is in Virginia, and he says, I listen to quite a few space shows, and there is another ongoing discussion that I would like your ideas about. David hasn't brought it up yet. Many people, due to one possible commercial vendor, believe it is possible to take an airship or a large blimp-like structure to orbit. And this has caused quite a bit of stir on different blog entries for the space show, because people who claim to be physicists and engineers say you can't take an airship to orbit, the physics don't allow it, and people who don't have that background don't see any reason why you can't make an airship go to orbit, even one starting at 140,000 feet, from a floating platform, which is part of the business plan of the company in question. Based on your academic and real-life experience with propulsion and getting to orbit, do you think an airship could go to orbit?
Wow. that would be a really, really difficult engineering challenge. I'm not sure I would say the physics prevents it, but you would have to approach it very carefully. You'd have to start from a very high altitude, and then with a significant but still relatively low thrust, gradually boost the airship to higher and higher speeds. At the same time, you know, lifting it more out of the atmosphere so that the residual upper atmosphere wouldn't destroy it on the way out, because the speeds become quite high and the thermal heating and atmospheric drag and all of that. So you'd have to shape a low thrust trajectory very carefully to stay inside of aerodynamic drag and thermal constraints. I've never sat down and tried to think about what such a trajectory might be like. So I'll just leave it by saying I think it might not violate the laws of physics, but it's going to be really hard.
Tim is in Huntsville with an email question for you, and he says, your guest said that NASA can't send astronauts beyond LEO because it's been 45 years since the end of Apollo, and that NASA is not ready yet. But the argument 10 years...
That's not what I said.
Okay.
What I said was I didn't think we were ready to go to Mars because it had been 45 years since we'd even been out of low Earth orbit, and that we needed to... I didn't use this term, but I will now. We need to get our space legs under us again. I certainly think we can... Within a very few years, I think we could be back on the surface of the moon if we had a policy and the funding to do it.
Let me see if there's anything relevant in the rest of his question. The argument from 10 years from now will be NASA can't send astronauts because it's been 55 years. Isn't that a vicious cycle? Okay, no, because he has what you said wrong. So his question has been negated.
I'm basically saying one thing. I don't think it is an effective approach to go to Mars directly as our next step in space. I think we need to return to the moon first. First of all, because the moon itself may be a very interesting place, we don't yet know. Second of all, because I personally would not see us as Western society abandoning the moon to Chinese interests. And thirdly, because I think we need to regain the experience base that we once had before setting out for Mars. Those are the points I'm trying to make, and it's certainly not making the point. And I'll emphasize again, I'm not making the point that NASA can't send astronauts beyond low Earth orbit. That's just not what I believe.
I think we have our caller back on the line. Hi, caller. Can you hear me? Welcome to the Space Show.
Hi. Yeah, it's Kim in Mexico.
Okay. Kim in Mexico, you're on the phone with Dr. Mike Griffin.
Hi, Dr. Griffin.
Fine. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I have looked a lot at how NASA has talked about what they're trying to do in space, and I've thought, for instance, about the ARM mission and how much it really seems to me to have to do with a first step towards space mining, but NASA almost never mentions that, and in part because of the kind of projects that I do. I wonder if NASA has trouble talking about things that are outside of its immediate mandate, even though there are things that NASA would love to do. And if they think about the applications of these missions to all these other things, but they can't see that's part of what the mission is about. Is that true?
Well, I might phrase it a little bit differently. Agency heads, which certainly include NASA, agency heads are responsible for executing the programs that they are told to execute with the money that is given to them by the President and Congress. And in the end, the old saying in Washington is presidents propose and Congress disposes. So in the end, the legal authorization and the financial appropriations come from Congress. So an agency head who works for the president and is subject to congressional law can't stand up in public and say, well, I think we ought to be doing this or that or the other thing that's not authorized and appropriated. It's considered to be insubordinate. Now, somebody outside the government, somebody in academia, somebody in business, somebody such as yourself, somebody such as me now can say, I think NASA should be doing, you know, fill in the blank. But when you're in the chain of command, your moral and legal obligation is to support the program, which has been enunciated by the president, approved by the Congress, and funded by the Congress. That's what you have to do. So space mining has not, by any Congress of which I am aware, space mining has not been authorized or appropriated. NASA administrators and NASA senior officials can't stand up on a soapbox and say, you know, this is what I think we ought to be doing.
But they can't even say, you know, the R mission would also help with that goal?
Somebody can say it, sure. I mean, they're not gag orders, but you can't propound it as a space policy. If you have not served in a government chain of command, it's difficult to explain that is a really constraining thing. I've been inside government and been outside government, and I think I am aware of the benefits that government programs can confer and achieve, and I also think I'm aware of the constraints that go with them. When I was administrator, there were things we were doing that I would rather not have been doing, and things that I thought we should be doing that we weren't, and I always wanted more money than I had. But you cannot say those things.
Well, you could go to the Hill to appeal for more money, right?
No, you cannot.
You can't even do that. How do you get to the appeal to go get more money? Because we see them appealing all the time.
You do not do that.
You do not, okay.
If you're an executive branch employee, you support the president's budget, whether you agree with it or not. If you disagree badly enough with it, you resign. If you listen carefully to my testimony, when I would be asked by the Congress if I thought the budget for NASA for this project or that project, depending on a member's, you know, home state interest, I was asked if I thought the budget was enough. I would always say the budget is adequate to do that which the president believes should be done.
Kim?
So that would seem to mean that it falls to advocates to present a vision, which is what I personally have been working on. But it seems that the thing is all right, this is my pitch, and I just would like to hear your reaction. I think that in order for the public to have any real enthusiasm for a big program in space, they have to understand what happens in the long term after you make that investment. And they need to have that explained to them very realistically, but also to have the full panorama of what it would really mean. And, you know, not in 10 years, but in 30 years or in 40 years. And NASA can't do that. And there hasn't been a lot of other advocacy that really focuses on that either. Do you think that could be important?
Well, I do think it's important. Public advocacy for NASA and for space exploration has always been high. I've said before, you know, every time that I am aware that a national poll, whether Gallup poll or other poll, is taken, and those sorts of questions are asked, something on the order of 70% of the populace, the U.S. population at any rate, supports or strongly supports space exploration and NASA. I mean, there's not a commercial company in the world that wouldn't like to have that kind of brand recognition and support. But at the same time, support for NASA has never been very deep, because when you start asking people follow-up questions, which, and we did this experiment once, start asking people follow-up questions about what it is about NASA and space exploration that they support, they really run out of answers quite quickly. So, Kim, I agree with you. If you had the kind of public advocacy that could sketch out the whole vision and make it available to the populace as a paradigm for what we're going to do in space, I think people do respond. Look at how well The Martian did. As an aside, I mean, part of what that movie did was to put in front of people a vision for what learning how to live on another world could be like. So I do think that's helpful. But to ask a government executive branch agency to fulfill that function, you're asking them to do something that is beyond what they're chartered to do. And if I sound a stodgy old bureaucrat, I'm sorry. I am old. I'm not stodgy. But there are limits to what you can do in government service.
No, I understand that, actually. It's good to have that clarification. Thank you.
Is that it, Kim?
Yeah, I'll clear the line now.
Thank you very much for your call, Kim.
Well, that question, David, gets to one of my enduring frustrations, which is that all of us in the space community believe in what we do. Even if we fight among ourselves, we all have these grand goals, and yet they don't seem to end up being translated into money and, even more importantly, policy. And it is sometimes very frustrating.
You know, I hear from space cadets and space advocates lots of very creative ideas and grand visions. Now, I my background is in finance and economics, so I'm not an engineer, so I have a hunch as to what's plausible and what's on the fringe and what's beyond the fringe after doing this show for 16 years and talking to people. But I always say you have a great idea, and you've presented it in your self-published book or your paper at AIAA or here on the Space Show. What's next? How are you going to work to implement that as policy and to bring it to life? And there's long gaps of dead air on the phone line with them, because nobody knows how to go from their great idea or their great vision to anything close to a policy, to an actual project. And I don't know how to tell them to do it, because, you know, they may not have the connections, they may not, who knows what they may need to do it. But it seems to me that what's missing from a lot of great ideas and great visions is a pathway to make it real. And I don't know, do you have such a pathway?
Well, if I did, I would have already done it. No, I don't. Regrettably, it seems to me that we often only get really clarifying policies in the wake of disturbing events. I would remind all of our listeners, I think, would say, maybe not, most of our listeners would say that Apollo was a great thing. Well, Apollo didn't happen because President Kennedy was so interested in space exploration. It was his response to Russian initiatives, which he felt, if not countered, would make America and its Western partners look like they were on the wrong path relative to the communist Soviet Union. I remember those days. Most of our listeners No, I
remember them. Yeah, I remember them too. Thank God we didn't have Senate investigations with the mentioning of the word Soviet Union back then. But
yeah, and so the point was, it, for Kennedy, as everything I've been able to determine from the historical record, I mean, I of course never met the man. I was 12 years old when the Apollo speech was made, but the point being, it wasn't about space for Kennedy. It was about trumping the Russians. When Columbia was lost and, you know, space policy was rewritten again, it was because we had had a national trauma. And the Columbia Accident Investigation Board was very clear that, I can't quote exactly what they said, but they wrote down that we had had 30 years of drift in American space policy. And the Bush administration responded. Would that have been done without the Columbia accident? I personally don't think so.
No, I don't think it would have been there.
And so, you know, my regret is that we didn't stick with that policy. I hope it does not, I suspect it will, but hope it does not take another trauma of some kind to get national political leadership once again focused on the space as an American frontier. I wish it would happen.
Let me see if I can work in the remaining email questions that have come in, because I know we're getting close to the one-hour point. John, who is in Fort Worth, Texas, says, how do you see orbital propellant depots as playing a role in potential lunar or Mars missions?
Well, I've said a number of times that I think probably the first useful product to come out of lunar resource extraction will be oxygen, because we're going to be using oxygen and hydrogen as a propellant combination for a long time, and mass is what counts in space, and portions of the lunar crust are as much as 40% oxygen by weight, and the oxygen-hydrogen propellant combination is 7/8 oxygen by weight. So if you can do nothing but mine lunar oxygen and ship it up to low lunar orbit or store it on the surface, then you can very quickly get yourself to a point where your lunar lander is a fully reusable vehicle. You know, it gets fueled up at one end of the other or the other, but it doesn't get thrown away. And that's at the end of a very long gear ratio, and the mass of involved in not throwing away a lunar lander is quite valuable. So I think that will be one of the logically first beneficial applications of propellant depots, putting them in low lunar orbit and again, quite likely on the surface of the moon. People talk a lot about propellant depots in Earth orbit, and personally, I think that the time when you're going to see that is when we do get serious about Mars. I'm not sure that I, in fact, I'll rephrase that. I'm fairly sure I do not yet know the concluding argument on where our staging area should be to go to Mars. You can construct Mars architectures where you stage in low Earth orbit, where you stage in deep space, where you stage around the moon. I don't think that argument is settled, and there may not be only one answer. But when you start to assemble a Mars payload, you know, I don't care what propulsion method you use, it's going to be a lot of fuel, and you're going to want to put propellant depot where your staging area. I hope that response makes sense.
Okay. Let me see if I can squeeze my two more final questions in. Sheila says, and she's in Chicago, I'm a grandmother with a high school grandson in California. He tells me that my interest in space is a folly because we need the money to do all sorts of other things for people here on Earth, and he's actually taught things like this in school and taught, so he says, that money spent on space programs and the moon and things like that is a waste and is keeping it from needy people here on Earth. Do you have any comments or thoughts for my grandson, I told him to listen to this show because I was going to try to ask you this question.
Well, I'm glad it's asked, and I hate to sound heartless and cruel, but the half penny on the federal dollar, which is used for all of NASA, is regrettably not going to make any difference to any significant number of hungry people. That's the average American's share of the bill for space exploration is 15 cents per day. Run the numbers. The average American pays 15 cents a day to own our space program or his or her share of it. I am 100% certain that all of our listeners waste more money than that every day. As I've said in the past, I go through more than that on chewing gum. So
certainly
I just don't accept the argument that by exploring our frontier that we're depriving people of meals.
To me, the bigger question is how do you get teachers in class that teach this to kids because they don't understand the economics of what you've just explained in our budget. But that's beyond the scope of the space show. But, Sheila, that's what I'd be asking your son to go challenge his teacher, on does that teacher really understand the economics of what's being spent on space and what that means and on.
If the first concern is hungry people, you know, I think there might be other ways to address that issue, but I would then say, okay, well, then everybody needs to give up chewing gum and cigarettes and all forms of any non-essential good or service or product that they own and convert that to cash and give it to 100 people because the 15 cents a day you're spending on the space program is a drop in the bucket compared to the other luxury goods that are not being given to 100 people.
Paul is in New York, and this will be our last question, listeners. And he says, many people think that we are not serious about human spaceflight because we refuse or are incapable of determining the gravity prescription in humans beyond low Earth orbit, and we have no means of determining what gravity levels would be okay to make it safe for humans to go beyond low Earth orbit. Do you have any comments on our inability to have a program to determine that human gravity prescription for deep space or Mars or the Moon or something out beyond low Earth orbit?
Well, I'm an engineer and not a medical doctor, so I'm going to say, of course, I don't have any such prescription. But I think the higher level of the question gets to the issue of, you know, why exploration is dangerous in the first place. Yes, low gravity is over the long term harmful to humans, and we're going to have to figure that out. But I think saying that we can't go into space because low gravity is harmful to humans is like saying we can't learn to sail on the ocean because when people go on long voyages, they get scurvy. There was a fascinating book written about great voyages of exploration for their first several hundred years, during the course of which 2 million people died of scurvy. The title of the book was Scurvy, and it was a history of how the disease was first encountered, what amelioration was used to try to combat it, and how finally vitamin deficiencies were discovered and remedies put in place. But humans went on open ocean voyages for hundreds of years before that was figured out. Are we to be less adventurous than our ancestors? I mean, I hope not.
Mike, is there anything I should have asked you during this hour or that you would like to say or any pearls of wisdom you'd like to leave with us before we call it a show and a night?
I truly cannot imagine that I have even one pearl of wisdom. As I've said, I'm an engineer. I don't know how to conduct an interview. I have no idea what question you should have asked. I think you did a good job. Thanks for having me on the show again.
It's always a pleasure, and thank you for being here. And I hope somehow you find a way to be a very active contributor in our new administration. I think they can certainly benefit by your understandings and your interest and your ability to see clearly and to think clearly. So I wish you well with that. If I knew who to send letters and urge and nudge, I would do so. But I don't have those kind of contacts with the Space Show. But I hope someone out there does, and you continue to play an active role with us in developing space. And I look forward to talking to you again down the road.
Thanks, David.
Thank you, Mike. Have a good rest of the evening.
Thanks to all our listeners.
Thank you. And listeners, that's it for tonight. We do have Hotel Mars tomorrow and back Friday. And then no show Sunday due to Father's Day. Everybody have a great rest of the week. Good night from Dr. Mike Griffin, myself, and the Space Show.